We often talk about climate change as a matter of science, but the biggest questions are really about money. How much would it cost to fix it, and what price will we pay if we don't? Well, we're about to meet the man who invented the field of climate economics, and he says the best way to tackle climate change is also through dollars and cents. William Nordhaus wrote a book that lays out his idea in simple terms. NPR's Richard Harris took a trip to Yale University to talk to this celebrated economist.
The buzz here on the Yale campus is that it's only a matter of time before Bill Nordhaus lands the Nobel Prize. But there's not a trace of haughtiness in the gentle 72-year-old's demeanor.
Okay, coming upstairs.
He tromps up the staircase of this 19th-century building in his mud boots. Silver hair sweeps across his high brow. Nordhaus's expansive suite is part parlor, part library, and part office. He's been at Yale since 1967. And as we settle into a couple of chairs, he says his ideas about climate change date back to 1974, when he was a research scholar in Austria.
And I happened to share an office with a climatologist, and I was doing energy research, and he said, well, you know, this is where energy research is going to be going. And I said, well, okay, tell me about it. And that's how it started.
Some scientists were starting to think about climate change back in the early 70s, but Nordhaus says not so in the world of economics.
It was zero on the intellectual Kelvin scale in economics. There was nothing at that point.
Nordhaus started to grapple with the basic question. Climate change was looming because people were burning cheap fossil fuels. Carbon dioxide is building up in the atmosphere, and each ton increases the risk of sea level rise, shifting climate, and other changes that are likely to cost a huge amount of money to address in the future. Right now, nobody pays for that, and it wasn't even clear what the price should be.
When we did our first calculations, they actually spun out these shadow prices, and I remember looking at them and trying to think of what in the world does that mean.
He realized that those shadow prices actually represented the cost of putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And with that, climate change suddenly became a problem that could be attacked with the tools of economics.
Actually, from an economic point of view, it's a pretty simple problem.
If people would simply pay the cost of using the atmosphere as a dump for carbon dioxide, that would create a powerful incentive to dump less and invest in cleaner ways to generate energy. But how do you do that?
We need to put a price on carbon, so that when anyone, anywhere, anytime, does something that puts carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, there's a price tag on that.
After that initial inspiration, a lot of Nordhaus's work has been figuring out how big a price we should pay and what form it should take. It could be a carbon tax, preferably in place of other taxes, or it could be a cap-and-trade system where polluters buy and trade the rights to put carbon in the air. California and Europe are starting to put policies like this in place.
The real point of the pricing is not to gouge people, not to actually extract resources from people. It's to tilt the playing field in such a way that people, firms, governments, everybody move toward carbon-free or low-carbon activities.
Nordhaus has laid out how to do this in a book called The Climate Casino. The not-so-subtle point of the title is that we're gambling with our future if we don't do anything about climate change. And Nordhaus knows the challenge isn't the economics, it's us. His studies show that it makes economic sense to start paying the price now, even though the benefits would be decades away.
That's a pretty tough one. You have to be grown-ups, I think. There are lots of things we do where the investments come way, way in the future. Educating four-year-olds, I mean, that's an investment that goes way in the future as well.
But for this to affect the climate, he finds that at least half of the planet needs to work together, or it will be all pain and no gain. Nordhaus is hardly a saber-rattler on the subject, though he sees the potential for very serious problems down the road. He still says that global warming can actually be good for agriculture, at least up to a point. And he says we shouldn't do any more to address climate change than what makes economic sense, even if that means letting the planet warm up more than the international target of 2 degrees Celsius.
I know that sometimes environmentalists get frustrated that you sound calm and they don't feel calm.
What can I say about calm? What I like to think of the economics is a cool head at the service of a warm heart, and that's my approach to this.
People who have been dubious about climate change have, over the years, quoted Nordhaus's work to argue that it doesn't require urgent action. But lately, urgency has been creeping into Nordhaus's voice.
At some point, you move from calm to concerned. I'm not at panic, but I'd say there's some pretty deep concerns about what's going on, particularly at the slow pace of the steps countries are taking to deal with climate change.
His numbers show that the world can actually afford to take the steps we need to rein in climate change, provided that we make smart choices about how to do it. Richard Harris, NPR News.
It's been a rainy weekend here in California, but unless you're a tourist, that's a good thing. California has been locked in the grip of a historic drought. Farmers may be suffering, but as NPR's Nathan Rott reports, others are finding an opportunity.
Wayne Warren shakes wet dirt out of a plastic bucket and into a metal chute, tossing aside the bigger rocks. He's all smiles because for him, California's drought is...
golden.
Yes, golden. Warren is knee-deep in the San Gabriel River, an hour outside of Los Angeles. That chute next to him is a sluice box. The water washes away the dirt in a muddy cloud, and he leans over the box.
I don't know if you can see all that yellow in there.
Oh, yeah.
Out of the creek, he taps his findings into a green plastic gold pan and gives it a few swirls. What's left...
sure is pretty in the sun, though.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Guess that's why they call it gold, huh?
Yeah.
Consider this the golden lining of California's historic drought.
Yeah, it's good for the gold prospectors. They love it because they can get down to that bedrock without using any scuba equipment.
This is Kurt Timmons, another gold prospector and the owner of a mining supply shop just down the mountain. He's been walking the riverbanks of the San Gabriel his whole life.
Normally it'd be 6 feet over your head. And now it's so low, it'd probably be up to your knees in depth, if that.
Little rain and even less snowpack have made the San Gabriel River more of a stream. And it's not just here. Kevin Hoagland is with the Gold Prospectors Association of America.
And it's beyond just the state of California. Where I'm at in Arizona, we haven't even had our first snow yet.
He says that's opened up riverbeds there, too.
It's given people an opportunity to literally just go in with a gold pan and a shovel and be able to get in some of these cracks and crevices and find gold that you wouldn't normally be able to recover.
Hoagland says it's not 1849 again. No need to pack the wagon and head west. But it is exciting for most people. Not Maury Roos. He's the chief hydrologist at California's Department of Water Resources.
Well, it's a bad thing for those who need water, and I imagine it's not the best thing either for the fish that live in the rivers.
Roos says it's a good thing some people are benefiting, but overall, this drought is bad. Many of California's rivers are at or near record low water volumes, and even with rain, their outlook isn't good. He says that will affect fisheries, already endangered salmon, watersheds.
It would even affect the trees and the vegetation.
And that's not to mention the people, the cities that are under mandatory water restrictions, or the farmers who let their lands go fallow or unplanted. For a clearer picture, just go back to where our guys were looking for gold on the San Gabriel River. Follow it south to where it pools behind the San Gabriel Dam, and you'll see high water lines some 100 feet above the reservoir's surface. The three major dams in this canyon hold nearly 40,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of water. According to the Los Angeles County Public Works, less than 1% is available for release. That doesn't quite have that same golden glimmer. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This past week, France became the first European country to destroy illegal ivory in a high-profile public demonstration. It did so underneath the Eiffel Tower as part of a global effort to call attention to the illicit ivory trade. Officials say the trade not only wipes out the world's population of elephants, it also funds terrorism. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has the story.
In the shadow of one of the world's most iconic monuments, a chain of customs and police officers passes along elephant tusks one by one and lays them on a conveyor belt that feeds them into a giant crushing machine. A customs agent lets me briefly hold one of the ivory tusks.
I'm touching. Oh my God, it's so heavy. Oh wow. 16 pounds. 3 kilo.
The largest tusk on the pile weighs around 80 pounds, but not for long.
Looks like rocks on a beach. The ivory's ground down into rocks, and then it goes through a second process, and it's ground down even further into what looks like sand coming out the end of this machine.
En détruisant aujourd'hui
Speaking at the event, French Environment Minister Philippe Martin says destroying the ivory sends the strongest message to poachers and traffickers. Even though there has been a global ban on trading in ivory since 1989, elephants and rhinoceroses are still being slaughtered for their tusks, says Philippe Guermat with the World Wildlife Fund.
In the world, we have about 500,000 elephant live, and every year it's about 25,000 that are being killed, only for money.
Some animal rights groups say an elephant is killed every 15 minutes. The illegal ivory trade doesn't just destroy elephants. Officials here say it's also the fourth largest source of funding for terrorism. The radical Somalian Islamist group Al-Shabaab, which killed at least 67 people in a Kenyan shopping mall last September, is said to get nearly half its funding from the illegal ivory trade. Several African ambassadors joined in to watch the destruction of the more than 700 tusks and thousands of carved statues worth more than $1 million. Begum Taj is the Tanzanian ambassador to France. She says it sends the right signal to poachers.
Yes, it is very important because it gives a lesson that you can't go away with this. It will be destroyed, or you will be caught, or you will be taken to justice. So it is important for the public to see.
Most of the ivory here today was seized at Paris's Charles de Gaulle Airport, the main entry point for ivory into Europe. But China is the world's main customer. Customs officer Patrice Bonnet says being caught with ivory is just as serious as being caught with drugs.
L'ivoire est prohibé à titre absolu.
Carrying ivory is absolutely forbidden. If you have it, you risk huge fines, and the fines are getting steeper and the punishment tougher as the number of elephants diminishes.
China, the U.S., and several African countries also recently destroyed stockpiles of ivory. Hong Kong says it will incinerate 28 tons in the coming year. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The debate is settled. Climate change is a fact. And when our children's children look us in the eye and ask if we did all we could to leave them a safer, more stable world with new sources of energy, I want us to be able to say, yes, we did.
President Obama from the State of the Union address. Of course, in politics, and it seems especially when it comes to climate change, talk is cheap. Climate change, or global warming as we used to call it, has been part of our national discussion for over 20 years. But with today's political polarization and divided government, it seems harder than ever for the government to actually do anything. That's our cover story today. With the president and Congress at odds over how to address climate change, where does that leave the American people? The president has made it clear that he intends to set strict limits on power plant emissions through the Environmental Protection Agency. Republicans in Congress have made it clear that they want to find a way to stop that. But NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley says the president is already moving forward with another part of his plan without help from Congress.
The president's plan is partly about reducing changes to the Earth's climate, mainly by cutting back on greenhouse gases, but it's also about adapting to those changes we can't stop, and that means getting more resilient to floods or droughts or wildfires or invasive insects, all the sort of biblical plagues that come along with climate change. And this week, his agriculture secretary announced the creation of 7 climate hubs around the country. These will be national research centers that will focus on helping farmers and ranchers and others in rural communities to cope with climate change.
Of course, we've heard Republicans are not on board with most of the president's plan, most notably his intention to impose stricter regulations on power plant emissions. So are we headed toward a political showdown on this issue?
Well, it doesn't look as if Congress itself is going to tackle climate change. So one of the big tools in the president's toolbox now is the EPA, and that agency has been working on rules that would limit carbon pollution from power plants, especially coal-fired plants. They're responsible for about 40% of the greenhouse gases in this country. So there will be a fight over those rules, which the president wants to see finalized next year. The EPA is acting under the Clean Air Act, so it doesn't take affirmative action by the Congress to authorize this, but the critics in Congress will try to challenge that. Perhaps more importantly, the EPA authority is being challenged in the Supreme Court, and the High Court set to hear arguments later this month.
NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Thanks, Scott.
My pleasure.
One of the congressmen leading the fight against regulating power plants is Ed Whitfield, Republican representative from Kentucky. He says just because climate change is real shouldn't mean the government can hit power companies with overly strict regulations.
We have legislation that's been reported out of the Energy and Commerce Committee that basically says to EPA, when you set the emission standards, you have to set a standard that has been adequately demonstrated in the marketplace.
His proposal would prevent the EPA from setting drastically lower emission standards for coal-fired power plants. He says the president's plan to limit carbon emissions is rash and will hurt the economy.
He is moving quickly to transform the way electricity can be produced in America at a time when we do not have enough renewable power to come close to meeting the requirements.
That's Congressman Ed Whitfield of Kentucky. In Washington, the debate over what to do about climate change is split largely down party lines, but it hasn't always been that way. Senator John McCain actually campaigned on the issue in his presidential runs. Here he is in 2007.
Climate change is real. The earth is warming, and it is a result of greenhouse gas emissions.
Climate change was on the country's mind that spring because deadly storms were ripping through the Midwest.
Tornado emergency.
Large and dangerous tornado by the National Weather
Service. The worst tornado came on the night of May 4th, 2007. It was the most intense storm of a season that itself was the worst in 50 years.
A tornado emergency now in effect for Greensburg in Kiowa County.
Oh, tornado to the east! Huge tornado! Look at that!
Bob Dixon is a longtime resident of Greensburg, Kansas. He remembers that night vividly.
On May the 4th of 2007 at 9:40 at night, we lost everything, my wife and I, as did everyone in town. Our home was sucked off the top of the foundation, and there was no walls, there was no floor. We were in the basement, and it just took everything. What we had left was the clothes we had on our back. It's those little intrinsic things that you lose, like family recipes, like heirlooms.
11 people died, and 95% of the town was destroyed. In the aftermath of the storm, some people said the town itself was one of the casualties. Bob Dixon didn't think so. He ran for mayor, promising to rebuild the town. Now, Dixon is a Republican, but his approach? Attack climate change head-on. His plan? Rebuild Greensburg green to make it a safe, sustainable city. He won the election in a landslide. Now, halfway through his second term, Dixon has delivered. Greensburg has a new hospital and a new school built using sustainable architecture. There are wind turbines and solar panels all over town.
Well, right off the bat, and I'm going to be very candid with you and especially with me, whenever I heard the term green, all I could think of was the liberal left-wing New Age movement that we in rural America felt was just not appropriate. But when we drilled down closer to it and looked at everything, we realized that our heritage and our ancestors was based on those sustainable green principles. Our grandparents and our parents always taught us, if you take care of the land, it will take care of you.
People obviously would want to know, looking at Greensburg, why you've been able to have this be less of a partisan debate. Is it as simple as the fact that you've experienced that extreme weather that was so devastating?
Well, it banded us together. You can build the greenest community in the world. You can eliminate as much carbon emissions as you want. But if you don't have the people to inhabit that community and a vibrant economy that they can live and work and feed their families, you're not a sustainable community.
Do you feel like these policies put you at odds with national Republicans, with, say, Republicans in Congress?
We perceive certain things when we hear Republican or Democrat, preconceived ideas of what Republicans and Democrats think on issues, when in fact it should come down to what do we as citizens think about these issues, not what we're being told, but what we've investigated and how they can be implemented at the lowest level possible, which is our local level. It's about us as a society surviving and the ability to endure, and that's what true sustainability is.
Bob Dixon is the Republican mayor of Greensburg, Kansas. He's also one of the local leaders on the president's task force for climate preparedness. The UN panel on climate change warns storms will continue to get more severe and more frequent. Mayor Dixon is hoping Greensburg's approach can be instructive to other communities across the country as they brace for more extreme weather.
I wouldn't drink that water if you paid me.
That's West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller yesterday telling NPR he does not trust his own state's water. More than a month has passed since a chemical spill left 300,000 West Virginians without usable tap water. Specifically, residents were told not to drink or cook with the water. While the ban has been lifted, officials will not declare the water safe to drink. The accident has renewed the debate over regulations versus the environment. That debate in a state where those arguments have usually tilted in one direction, NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
It's a small word, safe, but try as she might, Republican Representative Shelley Moore Capito couldn't get witnesses at a congressional hearing in Charleston yesterday to utter it. She tried first with the head of Charleston's water supply company, Jeff McIntyre.
Is the water safe to drink?
As a water company, we don't set the safe standards, but we are in compliance with all the standards set by the health-based agencies.
Capito then put the question to Letitia Tierney, commissioner of West Virginia's Department of Health and Human Resources.
Dr. Tierney, is the water safe to drink?
Everybody has a different definition. Am I confident in the science? I'm as confident as I can be, given what we had.
While the investigation continues into the accident, residents continue to have misgivings about Charleston's water supply. People still line up at water distribution points, and restaurants serve bottled water with lunch. Sue Davis testified that she's lived in the Kanawha Valley, also known as Chemical Valley, for 71 years.
We simply don't have that much confidence in your water system to begin with, so it's going to be a long time before you restore faith in it again, and you will never have mine.
West Virginia has long relied on the exploitation of its natural resources to provide its residents with a way to earn a living. If coal is no longer king here, it is still a force to be reckoned with, and the chemical industry also has been a key part of the economy. The federal EPA has been portrayed by some state officials as the enemy, but last month's spill may be changing the equation. Republican Capito is sponsoring a bill requiring oversight and inspection of chemical storage facilities.
I don't think the point is that anybody wants no regulations. You want regulations that protect the air and the water in a common sense way. And I think in this instance, we've seen there are enormous gaps both in the state and the local responders and in the federal law. So I think what we need to do is address the regulatory gaps. I think that's what we're expected to do.
Democratic Senator Joe Manchin famously ran a campaign ad in which he fired a rifle aimed at federal environmental legislation. Manchin says what happened with Charleston's water should serve as a wake-up call.
There's got to be a balance between the economy and the environment. To a certain extent, it always has been.
Does this incident, though, show that maybe things are not so much in balance?
Well, it shows that basically throughout the whole country, this could have happened anywhere. It happened right here. We have to anticipate what could happen and prevent it if we can and be able to handle if it does. And that's where we are.
Manchin, too, is sponsoring a bill in the Senate requiring regular inspections of above-ground chemical storage facilities. All of this gives a bit of hope to advocates like Angie Rosser of the West Virginia Rivers Coalition.
Sadly, it took a catastrophe to get us here, but it's encouraging that light is being shed on some of the systemic problems that we've endured in West Virginia at the cost of our water.
And many say the water here still contains the telltale odor of licorice associated with the leaked chemical, and they're far from ready to declare it safe. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Charleston.
Writer Elizabeth Colbert set out on a global journey to study extinction. She went on a nighttime trek through streams in Panama, where the once common Panamanian golden frog, the color of a taxicab, is now extinct in the wild. She swam in the frigid Tyrrhenian Sea off Naples, with scientists studying what happens to marine life when CO2 emissions make oceans more acidic. And she slogged through the sweltering Amazon rainforest to chart the effects of habitat loss on biodiversity. The title of Elizabeth Colbert's new book, The Sixth Extinction, means this: we are in the midst of another catastrophic epoch. And she explains, while the other mass extinctions, over half a billion years, were caused by geological forces, this one is caused by one species, human beings.
There are five previous mass extinctions, the most recent of which was the
one about 65 million years ago that killed off the dinosaurs. And there's a pretty broad consensus that that was caused by an asteroid impact. And so now you will hear scientists say, we humans are the asteroid.
We are the asteroid because what are they pointing to?
Well, they're pointing to this idea that we're changing the world very, very rapidly, maybe not quite as rapidly as an asteroid, but if you look through geological time, rapid change is very unusual. So among the ways that we are changing the world very rapidly is we're changing the atmosphere by pouring a lot of CO2 into it very, very quickly. That also has the impact of changing the chemistry of the oceans very quickly because a lot of our carbon emissions end up in the oceans. We are moving species around the world very fast. When you think about it, it's very, very hard for most organisms to, you know, cross an ocean, or if they're a marine organism, cross land. That now happens all the time. We're just altering the surface of the Earth. Something like 50% of the surface of the Earth has been altered by people by now. So those are just some of the ways that we are changing the world very, very quickly.
And when you look at species lost, what do the numbers show is going on right now?
Well, if you look at the number of species, for example, that are on what's known as the Red List, which is kept by a group that sort of keeps the list of endangered species, they are increasing all the time. It's estimated that a quarter of all mammals on the planet are endangered. It's estimated that about a quarter of all sharks and rays are endangered. A third of all reef-building corals are endangered. Something like 40% of all amphibians are endangered. So these numbers are very, very high.
You profile a number of these species through the course of your book, and you go to the southernmost tip of the Great Barrier Reef to look at coral, try to see what's going on with coral reefs. You're about 50 miles off the coast of Australia. How dire was the picture that was painted for you when you went there?
Well, that was an amazing spot. We were on this tiny little island that just pokes above the reef, so you're almost effectively living on the reef. And every day the scientists would go out and walk across the reef to go collect water samples, and they were trying to look at how the rate basically at which reefs are putting on weight, because as one scientist put it to me, they have to keep growing just to keep constant. And what we're doing by changing the chemistry of the water is we're making their job harder and harder and harder. And the Great Barrier Reef has lost something like 50% of its coral cover just over the last 30 years, which is a pretty astonishing figure. And there are very robust predictions in the scientific literature that by around 2050, the Great Barrier Reef is going to have a very, very hard time surviving.
You do have an amazing description in there. You happen to be there at the time of the annual mass spawning of coral. You call it synchronized group sex, and you go out for a nighttime snorkel to see what that's like. Can you describe it?
What happens is that corals, once a year, they engage in this sort of orgy, I guess you could call it, where they all give up their gametes at one time, and these are these little tiny bead-like things that contain both sperm and eggs, which is pretty unusual. And so when they're ready to spawn, they spawn on the same night. This is so they can, you know, mix up their genes. It happens around a full moon. It can be anticipated when it's going to happen. So that's how I knew to be there. And then we went out at night, and it looks like it's snowing upwards. All of the corals suddenly start to release these little beads which float to the top. So it's sort of like a snow globe, but going in reverse. And it's a wonderful, wonderful sight.
Let's talk a bit more about the human role in this current mass extinction, because you have a line in your book where you say, when you think about why humans are so dangerous, maybe you picture a poacher in Africa with an AK-47 or a logger in the Amazon gripping an axe. But then you say, picture yourself holding a book in your lap. In other words, man's impact on nature and on species isn't necessarily malevolent by design. It's part of what we're doing to the Earth by our very nature of being on the Earth that you're saying is implicated here.
Yes, I think that a lot of these conversations are often as if there are good people, you know, and bad people. And my point is that change is really what is significant. And many of the qualities that are best about humans, most wonderful, most marvelous, most miraculous, our intelligence, our ability to cooperate and build these tremendous societies, our inventiveness, they have this interesting side effect, which is that we don't wait for evolution to provide us with a new tool. We make that tool. And that just turns out to be when you're another creature who does have to proceed at the pace of evolution to be very difficult to deal with.
Well, in the midst of all of the extinction that you're documenting in your book, you also profile the people who are working as hard as they can to preserve what's left of species that are disappearing. And I was really interested to read about an Institute for Conservation Research near San Diego, where they are taking care of a Hawaiian crow. The crows are extinct in the wild, and this particular crow is named Kinoe. And there's one woman who ministers to him in a very particular way. I guess that's, for lack of a better word, I'll say she ministers to him.
Yes. She strokes him very lovingly, hoping that a male bird will find this, you know, sexually exciting. How's that? Let's put it that way. So that she can collect a vial of his semen and rush it to Maui.
And how has that been going?
It hasn't been going that well. She during mating season, she tries to emulate when it's mating season on Maui, so it's in the spring. She will spend hours doing this several times a week. But when I was there, which was about 9 months ago or so, as she put it to me, he had still failed to produce any high-quality material.
And when you talked with this woman who's so dedicated to this cause, her name's Barbara Durant, what did she tell you about why she does what she does?
Well, this is an institute really devoted to trying to save some of our most endangered animals. And I guess I would say it's an act of love. I mean, it's an act of trying the best we can to preserve the remnant of this species in some way. And the really interesting and moving thing I found about Kinoe is he seems to have a lot of self-consciousness. And crows can imitate human speech. And Kinoe says, "I know." It sounds a little bit demented. It's hard to understand. But that is the message that he gives you, "I know."
You've covered the environment for a long time, written a lot about this. Were you surprised as you read more and studied more and traveled more for this book, surprised at what you found?
Well, I think I was surprised by the scope and reach of what's going on. I recently, for example, just heard a very eminent scientist say, you know, this may be the last century that we see large animals out in the wild. We're just not going to see them anymore. They're going to the extent that they exist at all, they will only be in zoos. That's a pretty sobering fact. And even I, after researching this book, was pretty sobered to hear that.
Elizabeth Colbert, her book is titled The Sixth Extinction, an Unnatural History. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.